3CR, your station, your voice.
Coming up is a podcast brought to you by the dedicated and diverse volunteers at 3CR. Just a quick message before you get there. For the month of June, we're asking listeners to donate to the station to help keep us going. We rely on the generous donations of the community to survive. Go to 3cr.org.au/donate and show your support for community-owned and community-run media. Thanks for your support and happy listening.
Welcome to Tuesday Home Time with Jan Bartlett. And it's only weeks now to the Radiothon, and we'll be hearing more about that to keep this wonderful independent media outlet on air for another year. But today, a country profile of Guyana on the northeast area of South America with Sasha Gillies-Lacakis. Midterm elections in the Philippines with human rights activist Peter Murphy. Dr. Binoy Campmark looking at Signalgate, amongst other issues. And, of course, we have Mr. Kevin Healy with his week that was.
A week, Jan Lister, when big Supremo Anthony Albanese headed off on his first overseas trip, take two, to cuddle up to his very, very close friend, Indonesia and other people's business, Supremo Brobao Tamio, whose main claim to fame is slaughtering lots of Timor-Leste people in a week when Indonesia-entrained killers murdered more West Papuan freedom fighters opposing Pro-Bautu's illegal occupation. Interesting, actually, Anthony's very, very close friends number illegally occupying war criminals like Pro-Bautu and Zion Supremo Benjamin, not another Yahoo, and fine Democrats like Indian Supremo Murdery. But given the close friendship, there could be no doubt Anthony would have raised the cause of the West Papuans and expressed true blue Aussie's opposition to the occupation and slaughter, quite possibly with as much force as he and our minister for going overseas all the time and being a perfectly good little prefect, Penny Left Wing, expressed their opposition to Benjamin's slaughter, destruction and genocide, particularly in this week of Nakba. Anthony jetted off from Western Troubler Aussie, where State Supremo Roger Cook the Planet and the Great Resource Behemoth issued his instructions on the upgraded new environmental legislation. He promised, after kicking former Minister for seeming to care about the environment, Tania Plibersek, in the guts, after exposing the glaring weakness in her proposal for a federal environment protection authority protecting the environment. Yes, what was that weakness, Anthony? Well, first and foremost, it might have worked. I had no choice. It would have created havoc on the great resource giants. I had the Western Troubler Aussie socialist government and the resource giants ready to tear strips off me if we'd gone ahead with this reckless legislation. But all is well. Anthony and the great resource giants and the Western Troubler Aussie socialists and Anthony's new Minister for Environmental Destruction, Murray knows what's needed, know what's needed. And it's not like the resource giants don't care about the environment, but they understand we need to strike a balance between protecting the environment and protecting their profits. The sensible balance, so we can expect a tough bill for the poor resource giants when Murray does what he was appointed to do. After, and this is one of their biggest complaints, they weren't consulted by Tania on the disastrous bill. Imagine, legislation to protect the environment, protect disappearing species, protect terra nullius, non-land, non-people, sacred sites, not consulting the big polluters, not seeking the sensible balance. It's like drawing up laws about murder and armed robbery without consulting the murderers and armed robbers business council. But Murray knows what's needed following his previous major achievement, sacking the evil construction union, showing Murray knows how to listen to the national interest expressed by caring employers and their balanced, objective mainstream media. And after all, the great resource giants have already done for the environment. They keep facing headwinds, as the caring business class jargon goes. See, they've recently announced they've slashed their emissions by 50%. 50%. What an achievement. Well, we announced this some weeks ago. 50%. How could they without affecting their sacred profits, I hear you ask? Simple. they've changed the method for accounting for their emissions. It's genius, really. Keep polluting at the same stratospheric rate, but change the method of calculating them, and hey, presto, magic, leisure to man, you've halved them overnight. But that doesn't mean they don't face those headwinds, presumably highly polluted, dangerous headwinds. We know they can also pollute to their heart's content by offsetting that pollution through growing a tree at the back of Bali, for instance. Now, one of those brilliant schemes is being banned, paying farmers not to cut down those trees that already exist, even if they weren't going to cut them down in the first place. It's called avoided deforestation. Imagine how much pollution they must offset by leaving existing trees in the ground. Yet, a scientific report has suggested there's a fairly obvious flaw in the scheme. Of course, one way to avoid the whole offset issue would be not to in the first place. No, that would give them nothing from which to transition. Our new caring business class supremo and party supremo and would-be big supremo was born Susan Lees and Dregs, S-U-S-A-N, but in her teens, getting into superstition or, well, numerology, she was told a double S would bring her luck, so little Susan became Sussan. Given the spelling, it has to be pronounced Sussan. And I raise this because the late activist Joan Coxedge described most conservatives as sus. In fairness, Joan called anyone who disagreed with her a sus, but be that as it may, numerology fanatic Lees and Dregs has done it for us. Presumably, her ambition is to run the country based on a daily check of the numbers or the stars or some other reliable political portent. She has aped her coalition partner, the Hayseed and Sheepshit Bunch, by hinting she may dump the zero emissions target. My word, they're quick learners, aren't they? Unlike the socialists, who boast their commitment to net zero by the next century or two, through their commitment by approving more projects, more coal, more gas, because they know we must transition from fossils, and how can we transition from fossils if there's no fossils from which to transition? But spare a thought for poor Jacinta Jumping Ship Price. Elected one day as an invaluable hayseed and sheepshit contributor to the parliamentary democratic process, and deciding next day she could make an even more invaluable contribution to the caring business class party as deputy to would-be new supremo Angus Tailings, who unfortunately ended up tailing Sussan, leaving poor Jacinta stranded. But what a choice, Tailings versus Lees and Dregs, with Jacinta, loyal Jacinta, tagging along. And Angus's profound intelligence and judgment was borne out by his endorsement of Jacinta. "You've been a great inspiration to me," he eulogised. Jacinta, an inspiration, a great inspiration. We have to think, listener, that explains a hell of a lot. And aren't designations relative, like Sussan and even Tim Will Smash Worker's son, who won back his seat? We think he's won it back anyway. Tim, formerly with the Institute of Public Very, Very Private Affairs. Sussan and Tim, for instance, are described in caring business class relations party terms as moderates. They're about as moderate as the deadly tropical cyclones arising from the climate change they know doesn't exist. Then again, the aforementioned socialists Anthony and Penny are described as left, proving these terminologies are very relative. Speaking of cyclones, back to poor caring employers and more headwinds. Seeking their pound of flesh, the evil unions want the government to establish a wage theft tribunal to facilitate what's now a slow and onerous process, when we know there is no such thing as wage theft, just a hell of a lot of inadvertent mistakes associated with the complications of confusing awards. The good news for many employers is a tribunal decision won't make the slightest difference. The workers will never see their money anyway, and the caring employer can arise like a phoenix from the ashes and start all over again next door or down the road. A bloke called David Anderson, real name, ran a mob called Falcon Capital, holding superannuation for about 6,000 workers. And David also ran two upmarket restaurants, which won a couple of Chef's Hats awards. Well, it all hit the wall. God knows what's happened to the 6,000 workers super, but 12 restaurant workers are owed 220,000 and the public purse, the tax office, is owed 400 grand. What are the odds of those workers or the tax office ever seeing a cent? Poor David. And a mob called Erudite Legal, run by a delightful character called Shavesh Kuksal, again real name, forced a junior lawyer to work 24-hour days, all-nighters, a 79-hour week, and paid her a fabulous $1,000 for more than 225 hours over 3 weeks. That's a hefty, generous, almost $4.50 an hour. Well, $4.40, and it's from his own money. She even had to take leave to attend her ex-partner's funeral. Not surprisingly, the whole incident had a shocking effect on her health. Poor Shavesh was ordered to pay her $51,000 with interest, but to quote the Troubler Aussie Capitalist Review, it is unlikely the firm will pay the money, as records show a couple of weeks before the hearing, Erudite was deregistered. Lucky, lucky Shavesh. And the magistrate said the matter was not a serious breach. The mind boggles at what she might consider serious. Now some genuinely good news. Headline in the Washington Post. In the firing line, USR fighter jets keep tumbling off into the sea. Yes, wonderful news. A Navy jet missed the aircraft carrier and plummeted into the Red Sea. $104 million literally sunk. The crew bailed out. A week after another tumbled overboard while sailors were towing it in the Hangar Bay. And here's the best bit. Another was shot down accidentally over the Red Sea by another of US OB train killer ships. My goodness, they're giant minds, these train killers, aren't they? Meanwhile, their commander-in-chief was in Qatar, where he was promised a $1 trillion jumbo jet as a gift to replace Air Force One. Forget the little matter that the Constitution prohibits big supremos accepting such gifts. That doesn't apply to Donald, or, as he wrote with his renowned Logic and Constraint, crooked Democrats insist we pay top dollar for the plane. Top dollar in capitals. But finally, here's our week that was encouraging thought. Let's encourage Donald to try taking his new jet off on one of his aircraft carriers. Good afternoon.
The New International Bookshop's Big Red Book Fair is back for 2025. We'll have thousands of second-hand books for $3 each, 10% off new books, and a great moment to support Melbourne's longest-running left bookshop. This year, the fair is on Saturday, the 21st of June, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. in the ETU Ballroom, Trades Hall, 54 Victoria Street, Carlton. Can't wait to see you there. New International Bookshop is a 3CR supporter.
Your station, your voice. Throughout the month of June, we're asking you to support fierce, independent and community-controlled media by making a donation to our Radiothon.
We'll be taking donations online, over the phone and in the station to help keep 3CR going for another year.
The 3CR Radiothon kicks off in June. To donate, go to 3cr.org.au, call the station on 03 94 19 8377,
or drop in at 21 Smith Street, Fitzroy, during business hours. 3CR, your station, your voice.
Our country profile last month with Sasha Gillies-Lakakis was Suriname on the northeast coast of South America. Today it's neighbouring Guyana, and Sasha is back, and we need a starting point, Sasha.
And again, it's a unique one. We are looking at Guyana, or Guyana, however you prefer to pronounce it, which is Suriname's neighbour. We looked at Suriname last time in our last interview, and that's a smaller neighbour of Guyana. And then, of course, there's French Guyana, which completes the three Guyanas up in the northern end of South America. And Guyana is the largest of the three. It's the only English-speaking country in South America. It's got quite an interesting history because of that, and because of that very unique colonial history. Of course, it was a British colony, originally a Dutch one like Suriname, but eventually transferred to British control. Fortunately, it's had a very spirited resistance throughout its history. Of course, it was a slave colony, a plantation country for the British Empire. So, of course, there was a lot of very noble resistance on the part of slaves and African people who were forcibly taken there during the horrors of transatlantic slavery. But unfortunately, in its more recent history, particularly since the 90s, we've really seen Guyana transform into a neoliberal laboratory, not only for its own elite, to sort of test and manage its population with all sorts of different policies of austerity, World Bank prescribed economic recipes, which have been very, very debilitating for most Guyanese, but even for transnational corporations. And this very sadly has brought Guyana to the precipice of conflict with its much larger neighbor, Venezuela. But we will get to that towards the end of the interview. Of course, Guyana's history begins well before the Europeans with the indigenous peoples of the region. Now, back then, of course, Guyana, Suriname, French Guyana, that didn't even exist. There was a lot of transmigration and movement between this region and the surrounding densely forested Amazon in Brazil, in Venezuela. Of course, borders in the modern sense weren't recognized, but there were a number of indigenous tribes that resided in what is now Guyana, around nine to be specific. And these included those that would migrate up to the Caribbean, the Caribs and the Arawaks. And this was one of the routes that those people took to get to the Caribbean islands. They went up through the Amazon. Some went through Venezuela, through the Orinoco Delta, up into the Caribbean. Others went through the different Guyanas and out into the Atlantic Ocean and then up to the Caribbean. This was one of the regions where the Caribs and the Arawaks lived along the coast. But then there were a number of interior tribes that had come up from the Amazon and stayed within that forested interior of Guyana. And they included the Waiwai and the Warao, which were also in Suriname and French Guyana. So we had some very, very interesting and diverse indigenous peoples in Guyana, all sort of nomadic agricultural hunting civilization. So not big city states like we saw in Peru or in Mexico, much more nomadic, no sort of established cities or settlements as such. Certainly there were trading outposts, but by and large, there was very little remnants of human presence prior to the Europeans because these were nomadic peoples. They moved around the Amazon, they moved around the coastal areas, and with the exception of a few larger trading posts, I guess you could call them towns, that would be the nearest equivalent of, you know, a European mindset. But of course, the Europeans did eventually arrive at the Guyanas, and it was Christopher Columbus who first sighted them on his first voyage. This was in 1498, in particular what would become British Guyana, and he named it Guyana, which comes from an indigenous language, and it means the land of many waters, because of course the Guyanas are the confluence of a lot of different waterways. There's the Atlantic Ocean, Paramaribo River, which comes up through what is Suriname, and there's the Cuyuni River, which is in, depends who you ask, but it's in that border region, the Essequibo region between Venezuela and Guyana, and it filters out into the Atlantic Ocean. A very, very significant sort of area for a lot of indigenous people. That meeting of the waters along the coast was also a very significant spiritual location for a lot of the indigenous peoples of Guyana. And Christopher Columbus first saw that area on one of these early voyages in 1498. The Spanish didn't conquer it. They didn't bother to establish a settlement because, of course, they were more concerned with their newfound Caribbean possessions, of course, the Dominican Republic and Cuba and Haiti. And we also did get an early account from the English. This was sometime later. This was in the 1590s, 1596 specifically, where Sir Walter Raleigh, who was involved in the colonization of Barbados, had also gone down to the Guyanas and had done an initial survey and had recommended to the British authorities that this was an area that could potentially be turned into a plantation economy. But again, there was no settlement until the Dutch arrived very early 1600s. So in 1616, the Dutch established the colony of Essequibo, then the colony of Berbice in 1627, Pomeroon and Demerara, which are two other, now they're regions of Guyana. They were founded as colonies in the 1700s, so about 100 years after the first Dutch colonies were established. This was more or less under firm Dutch control really up until the mid-1700s, so the 1750s, when the Spanish begin to reassert their claim to this area. Of course, the Spanish had claimed the Guianas as part of Venezuela, as part of the Captaincy General of Venezuela in particular, that they often didn't have the authority or the manpower to exert control, actual physical control over the Guianas. So it was sort of more or less left to the Dutch, even though officially, you know, in a lot of areas of international diplomacy at the time, it wasn't actually recognized as a Dutch colony. It was by the Dutch allies, like the English and some German principalities, but certainly as far as the Spanish, the Portuguese, the French were concerned, this was a Spanish possession. This is where we begin to see, even as far back as the 1600s, the 1700s, the very, very contested nature of what is today Guyana. And it is, in fact, taken off the Dutch in the late 1700s, in 1795, specifically when post-revolutionary France invades from French Guyana and conquers the Dutch colony of Guyana and Suriname. And they occupy it right up until 1814. When we're still seeing the Napoleonic Wars roiling throughout Europe. Throughout this whole time, of course, we have this big picture European history, these, you know, titanic colonial wars between the different powers, between the Catholics and the Protestant powers, and then later between revolutionary France and the more conservative reactionary governments of the Netherlands and England. But of course, the people that were most affected were the everyday people living in Guyana. And at the time, those were the slave population, which outnumbered the Europeans by easily a ratio of 1 to 8 or 9, depending on the year. So for every one European, there was 8 or 9 slaves. So, you know, very, very big difference in demographic. And of course, there were a few indigenous people left in the interior. Most of them had been killed by the Dutch, the English, the Spanish, the French as well, because again, the borders at this time were very, very porous. But what we saw for most people was a typical plantation economy, sugar being cultivated for export, as in Suriname, as in Brazil, parts of Venezuela. This was the mainstay of the economy. And as a result, slavery was pervasive. It was pervasive across Guyana from the interior right through to the coastline. And people lived very, very brutal lives. This has been documented in many other countries that we've looked at in other interviews, including Suriname, that the treatment of these African slaves was horrendous, you know, horrific. We're talking about crimes against humanity being conducted on a daily basis against these people. For example, the British did import the French practice of dunking slaves in boiling vats of molasses on the coastline of Guyana as a punishment if slaves attempted to run away into the interior or attempted to rise up against the plantation masters. So these African people were treated as subhuman, as in the rest of the colonies. Regardless of which European power was in control at any given time, these basic conditions rarely changed. This was the mainstay and the reality for the majority of people living in Guyana. And as for indigenous people, the majority of them, as I said, had been killed out. They were reduced to a fraction of their former population. About 1/10 of pre-European population continued to survive and eke out an existence. There were some slaves, indigenous slaves. The majority weren't, however. The majority were basically pushed out into the interior, fled into neighboring Brazil and Venezuela, or they were simply killed to make way for plantations in the interior or for illegal gold mining, which has continued to be a recurring issue in Guyana, in the interior and along the border with Venezuela. So very, very stark, very, very difficult, grim conditions for the majority of people in Guyana. As I said, this was regardless of the European country in control. Now, the French, of course, did eventually lose their conflict with the majority of Europe when Napoleon was exiled to St. Helena and the French Empire was disbanded. And then, of course, we saw the British really reassert themselves and reassert their control. As I mentioned, in 1814, we saw the Anglo-Dutch Treaty, which essentially transferred control of what was called Demerara Essequibo. That was what the Dutch colony was called, which was pretty much what is today most of eastern Guyana, the part that is neighbouring Suriname, not the part that neighbours Venezuela. But it was called Demerara Essequibo, and that was transferred to British control. And then by 1831, that colony was combined with another much smaller part of land that the British previously owned, and that became British Guyana. Now, I want to emphasise, because this gets a little bit complicated when we begin to talk about the border region and what is called the Essequibo, I want to emphasise that at this point in 1831, when the colonies are combined, the Dutch colony with the English colony, that Essequibo region is still not a part of British Guyana. It was the Spanish Empire, and then it was officially part of Venezuela. Following Venezuela's independence in 1824, of course, we saw the independence wars in Spanish America from about 1810 really to 1820, 1825, depending on the country. Venezuela itself becomes independent in 1824. They have always claimed that the Essequibo region, which is about two-thirds of modern-day Guyana, as their territory. When we go back to the original maps from the 17th century, it is always referred to in these Spanish maps as Guiana Essequibo, which means the Essequibo region of Guyana, and that was always included as a part of Venezuela's territory. Even under the Spanish Empire, it was incorporated into the Venezuelan region of the Spanish Empire. And what we saw happen throughout the 1820s, so this is before British Guyana is officially created, is the British began to send settlers into the Essequibo region. This was in violation of, well, first Spain's and then Venezuela's territorial integrity. These settlers essentially began to take administrative control of the region. Now, as I mentioned, Spain very rarely could actually implement or assert its physical authority in this region. And particularly when we began to see the independence wars, Spain had very few resources to commit to the Guyana region. And so throughout the 1820s, we begin to see these British settlers gradually taking more and more land in the Essequibo region. And Venezuela, of course, similarly, straight after, you know, these independence wars, after the collapse of Gran Colombia, it was a militarily weak country, even though legally speaking, it did have the historical claim to the Essequibo region. It had no means to enforce that, really, when you're talking about Venezuela's quite small army against the might of the British Empire. There would have been no competition in some sort of actual conflict and military engagement. There were skirmishes when these British settlers were moving in and taking more and more of the Essequibo region. Venezuela constantly protested this in different international forums. It was very, very much against this sort of gradual, insidious sort of British takeover of the territory. And we saw that taken to new extremes when the British essentially hired a German explorer called Schombruch to basically explore, quote unquote, the region of the Essequibo and essentially draw up a new map. And this was financed by the British state, by the British Crown, draw up a new map that essentially drew up new borders, unilaterally drew up new borders that drew up at the borders of the Essequibo and of British Guyana to come right up to the border with Venezuela, so to incorporate the entirety of the Essequibo. Of course, the British Crown accepted this map. They are the ones who had financed its creation in the first place. They paid Schombruch very handsomely, and they said, well, this has been surveyed by a European. He's a well-known explorer. We've accepted it, and this is the new borders of British Guyana. This includes the Essequibo. Now, of course, Venezuela never accepted that argument. Of course, from the outset, legally speaking, it was fraught with flaws, with imperfections. I mean, the British had literally hired this man to draw up a map according to their specifications and their prescriptions. This was a long-running issue throughout the 19th century. Constant negotiations between the English and the Venezuelans over who owned the Essequibo. And ultimately, it came to naught. The British continued with their control over the Essequibo. They expanded their administrative reach. For all intents and purposes, it became British. The British had control over it, administrative rule, political rule, military rule. But Venezuela never recognized British control over Essequibo. I also want to mention again, you know, we can get caught up in the big power sort of stuff. On the ground for everyday people, the slave people living in the Essequibo, life continued much as it had prior to the creation of British Guyana. Of course, you know, the Spanish were brutal slavers themselves. Even if they had been incorporated into Venezuela as an independent country, even though slavery was officially abolished, of course, there was severe racial discrimination in post-Spanish Venezuela right up until really the 1990s with the Bolivarian Revolution. Life wouldn't have changed much. All of this big power tussling really didn't affect everyday life. It was still abysmal conditions, you know, poverty, widespread abuses by plantation owners, which still continued to control this region. And even after slavery was abolished in the 1830s across the British Empire, as we've discussed, you know, in countries like Jamaica, even in non-British colonies, in countries like Suriname, or which were Netherlands controlled, which ostensibly abolished slavery in the 1830s or a bit later in the 1850s, 1860s, it practically continued, you know, as a form of indentured labor or very, very poorly paid labor. Conditions really didn't change. This is an issue that Guyana has grappled with really right up until the 1950s, 100 years later, since the creation of British Guyana, because there hasn't ever really been a sort of national consciousness in the country. It's always been this very porous, ambiguous sort of region, not even a country, so to speak, in these sorts of tussles between different European countries. And then, of course, later with Venezuela as well in the picture. This was the situation in Guyana up until 1899, and this was when Venezuela had had enough with the British and had really protested to the point where, you know, it was like talking to a brick wall. The British were being extremely recalcitrant in the negotiations with Venezuela, which had now been ongoing for 70 years. And so Venezuela decided to take this case to international arbitration. So they took the Essequibo dispute to an international panel. We've discussed this again when we had our interview with Venezuela, that Venezuela was really betrayed by the United States in particular. Now, this panel, this international panel, which met in the Netherlands, an ally of the British, that's important to keep in mind, was composed of two Americans, three British and a Russian. And the Russian was invited supposedly to be a sort of independent mediator in between the two different sides, because supposedly the Americans were going to advocate on behalf of Venezuela's claim to the Essequibo region. And they had said that they would. They had said to Venezuela, let us take charge of the legal matters relating to your claim. We will represent Venezuela in this international arbitration. The Venezuelans perhaps quite foolishly agreed to this. And after just a few months of arbitration, the result came back with a unanimous decision in favor of the British side. So the Americans, the British, and that one supposedly independent Russian arbitrator, they all agreed that the British had control of the entirety of the Essequibo region. Venezuela was taken aback. They were outraged that the Americans had betrayed them like this. Now, of course, the time when the Americans were perhaps more confrontational with the British immediately after the American Revolution had well and truly passed, and they were now firm economic and political allies. So it's not that surprising to see that the British and the Americans conspired in this case to essentially, well, rob Venezuela of quite a legally sound claim. Force was used to maintain control of the Essequibo after this. And there has now been new evidence that has emerged. It actually emerged in the 1960s when this case again was raised in Geneva, and we'll get to that, that the British had actually invited the Russian delegate and one of the American delegates and essentially bribed them to agree with their side of the arbitration. So, you know, even from that perspective, and, you know, no one cares now except Venezuela. But, you know, the entire basis of Britain's claim to the Essequibo has been marred by one-sided, unilateral, basically illegal pronouncements and illegal decisions. If they were applied to any standard of international law, even at the time, they just wouldn't hold up. But, of course, Britain had, you know, essentially a monopoly on force, and there was nothing Venezuela could do in 1899. You know, it was an isolated country, and it was a country of the global south. It couldn't do anything against agreement between the Americans and the British. The Essequibo continued being a part of British Guyana. Venezuela never ceded its recognition of Guyana. It never has up until this day. So, you know, this is going to be a recurrent issue that we're going to talk about when Guyana achieves its independence.
Can you tell me what the prize was for this area? What was the issue?
The main prize, again, we'll get to, which has only been discovered in 2020, was oil. That wasn't a factor of consideration in the 19th century. What was very, very rich mineral reserves, bauxite in particular, and also the strategic location of the Essequibo region, because the Cuyuni River, this river that flows down into the Amazon and then, you know, the other way goes down into the Atlantic Ocean, is a very, very strategic point for commerce in the region, in particular the inter-country commerce. And we're looking at commerce between Venezuela, Guyana, Suriname, and Brazil. Of course, Brazil was the main factor that interested the British at this time, because after independence in Brazil, which, you know, was a very managed independence, there was no war of liberation. This was essentially a faction of the Portuguese ruling royal family taking control of Brazil and announcing its creation as an independent country. And the British came to control most Brazilian banks. British investors were heavily, heavily involved in Brazilian banking. And as a result, the Cuyuni River, which of course went out into the Atlantic, was a vital entryway for exports coming out from Brazil to go to England and Europe, and conversely for British commerce to come into Brazil. So this facilitated a lot of the commerce that was happening between Brazil and between Britain. So again, Guyana itself, it wasn't even considered, you know, the people's lives there. There was no real of attention paid to that. This was, again, seen in the scope of big power politics and of Britain's and Brazil's strategic interests. But of course, once Venezuela became so recalcitrant and became so dogged in asserting its claims, the Essequibo became very important as an area for the British to station their troops in the case of a potential wider conflict with Venezuela. Now, this never eventuated, at least in the Essequibo region. There were dozens of skirmishes across the decades, but really it was the strategic location of Guyana. But there were also mineral resources, and this is what the Americans were also interested in when they sided with the British in the 1899 arbitration, because it was American companies, of course, that were invited by the British to come and take advantage of those mineral reserves and the bauxite reserves and the gold reserves in particular. And as we mentioned, this is also what was very interesting about Suriname as far as the Americans were concerned when they came in again at the start of the 20th century. It was the bauxite and the gold reserves because of the alluvial plains along those waterways in the different parts of the Guianas. There are a lot of gold deposits, and they're very, very close to the surface. As I mentioned, in the case of Suriname, the same can be said for Guyana. This is what really attracted so much interest in this region. But of course, it's a very sparsely populated region, and this is one of the curses of extractivism when it's all done by a rapacious colonial power. All of these resources were dug up, the environment was destroyed, it was exported back to Europe, but there was no development of this area. Guyana today is one of the least populated countries, the least per kilometre on the planet. The majority, 90% of the population, is along the coastline, actually in two or three cities specifically, including the capital, Georgetown. But the Essequibo region in the interior has very, very few people inhabiting it. Very, very few settlements as well. There are no cities, just a few small isolated towns, and that's it, because there was no development of this region, and there hasn't been even since independence. This underdevelopment, extremely one-sided, extractivist sort of policy of the British regime, naturally, you know, it naturally lent itself to the creation of a sort of emerging trade union movement in the urban centres along the coast, in Georgetown particularly. This was a multi-ethnic, a multi-racial movement, because much like Suriname, after slavery was outlawed, we saw import of a lot of Indian coolie workers. Again, like Suriname, like the British West Indies in the Caribbean, a lot of Indian people came over to these parts of the British Americas. They worked as indentured labourers, and some of them set up small businesses. And in fact, in Guyana now, they are the majority of the population. They are 43% of the population. The Afro-Guyanese are 30%. And then there's 10% which are indigenous, and the rest is a bit of a mix of other ethnicities, Europeans, Asians. But this emerging working class consciousness really took root in Georgetown. As I said, it was a multiracial movement. At first, it didn't recognize race. It was explicitly, it was a socialist movement, even a communist movement among some of the factions. And they led very, very successful labor strikes across the major urban centers in Guyana that brought a lot of British commerce to a standstill. There was was even a blockade of the Kuyuni River by a lot of workers in the 1930s. This movement began to coalesce, and ultimately it was crystallized into a political party in 1950. And this party was called the People's Progressive Party, the PPP. This party was an explicitly socialist party. It had as its program the implementation of a Marxist-Leninist economic and political program project in Guyana. And it was led by a dentist called Chetty Jagan. He was an Indo-Guyanese dentist. He was actually born in a poor family, but won a scholarship to study in one of the prestigious universities in Georgetown. And he would eventually go over to continue his studies in England as well. And he was the leader of this movement, at least at the start. Of course, he naturally attracted the Indo-Guyanese to his banner because he himself was Indo-Guyanese. But he also made an alliance with a man called Burnham. Well, Forbes Burnham is his full name, was an Afro-Guyanese lawyer. Again, he was born into a poor family, won a scholarship, much like Chetty Jagan. Similarly, he was a socialist, or at least he declared himself to be a socialist. He drew a lot of the Afro-Guyanese into the party. So this really ensured, at least for a short time, that there was a unity of purpose and that the movement, the PPP's political objectives, superseded race. The overall vision of this party was creating a socialist Guyana. That's why their labor strikes and their unrest were so successful, because they were so unified in their goal. But sadly, this didn't last very long. We began to see fractures emerge in the lead up to the 1953 elections. And these are elections taking place in the context of British dominion. So the British, of course, are hosting these elections in eventual preparation for independence, because of all of these labour unrest and these strikes, you know, the economic damage it's causing, like in other parts of the British Empire, for example, in Africa, in Ghana and those sorts of countries, the British agreed to a managed transition to independence. And it looked like the PPP was going to win. Once they did begin counting the results in 1953, it was looking like a landslide victory for the PPP. Churchill, of course, feared communist takeover of Guyana, and he sent in soldiers to basically repress the PPP, arrest some of its leading members, including Chetty Jagan, but he was later released. And the election results were annulled. It shows Britain's commitment to so-called democracy when a result that they didn't like was, you know, looking more and more likely. They cancelled the elections and arrested the leading figures of the PPP.
You've been listening to part one of the profile of Guyana in South America. And later on in the program, we'll have part two.
Come along to the Darebin Intercultural Centre on Wednesday 21st of May for our Cultural Diversity Oration. Enjoy a talk by UNESCO Chair for Comparative Research on Cultural Diversity and Social Justice, Fedi Mansouri, followed by a Q&A session facilitated by comedian and MC Diana Nguyen. The Q&A will be followed by live music and light snacks. The oration will form part of the IC Nights monthly series. For more information, visit darebin.vic.gov.au/intercultural-centre, a 3CR supporter.
Did you know that Western Sahara is Africa's last colony? The issue of Western Sahara was raised in the Eddie Mabo case referencing Terra Nullius. Western Sahara is illegally occupied by Morocco. Indigenous Sahrawis are denied their right to self-determination. France continues to veto United Nations human rights observation in Western Sahara. Sahrawi people are being killed by Israeli drones. Like to learn more? Become informed. Become an Australia Western Sahara Association member at awsa.org.au. Australian Western Sahara Association is a 3CR supporter.
The 2025 Philippines general election was held on the 12th of May. during this midterm election, where the winners take office midway through the term of President Bongbong Marcos, all 317 seats in the House of Representatives and 12 of the 24 seats in the Senate were contested to form the 20th Congress of the Philippines. Local elections were also held for the executive and legislative branches in every province, city and municipality in the country. According to more local media reports, the unexpected results of the Philippines' midterm elections, in which incumbent President Ferdinand Marcos Jr. lost support to his main foes, the family of Vice President Sara Duterte, as well as to unaffiliated Liberals, has left the nation's politics even more uncertain than before. But before we analyse these results, we need to assess the free and fair aspect and credibility of the elections, focusing on the lead-up to Election Day and Election Day itself. The International Coalition for Human Rights in the Philippines conducted the International Observer Mission to monitor election-related and human rights violations. I spoke with the chairperson, Peter Murphy. Peter, we'll talk about the elections soon, but in that lead-up, where did the International Observer Mission begin its work, and who are those undertaking the mission, and where did they go?
They're volunteers, mainly from North America, in Canada and the United States, who've travelled to the Philippines to take part in sort of fairly methodical observation of the elections. So we have some partners. This is the International Coalition for Human Rights in the Philippines. We have some partner organisations which focus on the elections in the Philippines that we've been able to work with.
And how widely do they travel within the Philippines in the run-up?
They were allocated to four different regions. They just stayed in those regions, but within the scope, say, the northern Luzon, there's several provinces. So I think that they're able, over a few weeks, to travel to quite a few places. And we've got a picture, you know, from Zamboanga to northern Luzon. So it's a reasonable sample of the situation.
So you've described it as red flags on credibility. Can you explain?
Credibility, yes. Well, I think, unfortunately, the reports have shown, this is from our own observers as well as our partner organisations who are bigger in scale, that the threats to candidates and their supporters through red tagging, which is an accusation, like a denunciation, that these people are terrorists or supporters of terrorists, that was rampant across the country. And it got more intense closer to voting day, May 12. And this time, I think, even compared to 2022, it seemed more systematic, more intense, and better coordinated. For instance, there was one day, I think it was May 10, when in many locations across the country, there was a display of coffins with pictures of dead New People's Army fighters and little signs saying that, you know, this candidate or this group of candidates are all supporters of these terrorists, and this is stop the killing of people, you know, blaming them for all of the trouble. You know, some of the coffins were worth a lot of money. I think, you know, this was quite, this one took people's breath away for a little bit. So you can't underestimate the impact of fear. But besides that, there was actual violence. There were quite a few people killed, even on voting day itself. I think there were at least 10 people killed. And some of our observers witnessed many, many cases of coercion using firearms or physical attack. So, you know, it was really prevalent. And their comment was, well, even frightened and anxious, people did still come out to vote. And it could be that the voter turnout this time is this highest ever or very high. So there's that. And then that in itself should be enough, you know, to cast a doubt over the whole operation of the election. There were also cases reported of police officers and military personnel engaging in coercion and interference in the election campaigning as well.
How were the votes counted?
Well, I'll go one more. Sorry, Jan. I'll just say that vote buying, that is people going around offering money to people for their vote, was also rampant, like it was in 2022. It doesn't seem to have quite reached the proportions of a festival of vote buying, but it was there was a lot of money pushed and competitions, you know, between candidates for how much they could pay for voting. And then there was the deployment of vote watchers at the polling booths who really were scary. You know, they were more like agents of candidates who'd paid the money, checking that the people did what they were paid for. Yes, I think there's a lot there which should discredit this election. There's even more happened with the counting.
Well, can you explain what the counting machines do and what they don't do?
The voter gets a ballot paper and has to, you know, mark in or shade the an area next to the candidate or the party that they're supporting. And there were, you know, on the ballot paper there were names of, you know, local government and provincial government, and as well as the House of Representatives and the Senate. So there's a lot on the ballot paper, and so the voter would mark the ballot paper and then enter it into a machine which would scan it and get a printout, a little receipt, which should record, you know, what their vote was, so that they know that it was actually recorded correctly as well. And now a lot of these machines, like hundreds of these machines, didn't work. And then another number of these machines read smudges or arbitrary lines on the ballot paper as a vote. And because there were too many of them on the ballot paper, they would then say it's an invalid vote. So there was a lot of that reported as well. And then there were other places where there were no machines and people had to queue for a long time. And in some cases, the voting person, you know, the staff of the Comelec said, please just put your ballots in this cardboard box here and we will put them through the machine later on. So that was a very much an unreliable situation. So we don't really know how many votes were affected by that. But again, another proportion is, and then there were the people who turned up to vote and their name was not on the voter roll, even though they were long-standing voters. This happened even to one of the candidates for the Senate, Amira Lidasan, who's a Moro leader from Zamboanga. And she went to vote and found her name wasn't there. So this is another form of voter manipulation, and some people taken off. And then we have the counting, which allegedly is done by those machines, and they were connected to the internet and were to transmit their results at the end of voting, which was 7 p.m. on Monday night in Philippine time. And there was an initial burst of data coming through the national Comelec servers so that people could see what was happening. And then for about 15 hours, it went off. That led people again to really worry that there was a manipulation happening in the computer system before votes again started to appear as totals. I think that the counting itself was also very dubious, in fact, non-credible.
Just thinking about the invalid voting papers, we see that the ridiculous Senate paper that we have here in Australia, and if they've got similar voting sheets in the Philippines, and I'd imagine there'd be a lot of people in the rural areas maybe who find it very difficult to either read or write things on a normal day, to be confronted with ballot papers like that and know how to fill them out properly. They don't have anyone helping people to understand, or do they do that beforehand?
They have that sort of education. And also on I told you about the watchers. The watchers, you know, are like the people who are able to go into the voting booth with the voter and allegedly help the blind one or the one who's illiterate and so on. But really, they were intimidating. There's that. But, you know, the voting is a bit simpler. Like here, we have preferential voting. You have to have numbers in sequence and all of that, a number every square. In the Philippines, it's really a first past the post. You just vote for the Senate candidates you want. In this case, people could vote for up for 12. And if they didn't vote for 12, their vote still counted, you know. So it's like, you know, just filling in a square, not even writing a number. So, you know, it's not that complicated compared to what we have to do here. But there are, I think there were something like 156 parties running in the section of the election called party list. It's a little bit like our Senate election, and it's like a proportional representation for a certain number of House of Representative seats. So that would have been, I think, a bit of a challenge for people to recognise that party that they wanted to vote for. And a lot of these 156 are just fronts for really rich and powerful families or business interests. That's another problem. But I don't think the voting is that complicated that a person can't, you know, make the marks that they want.
Well, I imagine that international observers have been watching the Philippines elections for decades. Is this one any different, or is it getting worse?
Well, I think it's getting worse, just because everything continues to get more sophisticated, and election manipulation, you know, is a global industry. There's consultancies that people hire to, you know, interfere with or massage the process or develop certain styles of campaigning which have an impact. So I think in this case, there was a change of the company which provided the automatic voting machines. They're obviously different software, and it was meant to be better than the problems that's seen in 2022, but I think it's probably come out as bad as or worse. And again, the a lack of transparency for that crucial period after the voting closed, and when results were meant to be being posted and then they weren't posted. It's a dead giveaway for interference in the using the software to shift votes around. You can see it in some of the outcomes, you know. Some of the party lists which I know well, which have been able to get elected every election since 1998, They got knocked out in 2022. They normally get millions of votes. They just got a few hundred thousand votes. And this election, they got even less. But a party list which last election missed out just had a couple of hundred thousand votes. This time got nearly 3 million votes. So, you know, it's anomalous. And I think it reflects different deductions and additions of votes according to alliances or arrangements among the powerful people.
Well, this is a midterm election. How does it differ from a full-term election?
The big difference is that the president is not elected in the midterm, but the whole House of Representatives, half of the Senate is, as would happen in the main election, which is due in 2028. So, you know, it's a really big deal. And in this current political climate in the Philippines, there's a real conflict going on between two powerful political dynasties. That's the Marcoses and the Dutertes, who were allies at the 2022 election. But they're really, really at each other's throats now. President Marcos, for instance, facilitated the arrest of former President Duterte under a warrant from the International Criminal Court, which was transmitted through Interpol. And so the senior person in the Duterte clan is in jail in The Hague. But his daughter, Sarah, is the vice president. And late last year, she made a sensational statement that she'd organised a hitman to kill the president and his wife and his cousin in the case that she herself was killed. So this is how deadly the threats have become between these people at the top of the political system there. And now she got impeached on charges of misuse of funds, like corruption or graft, and bringing disrepute on the Congress by the death threats. And the trial will happen in the Senate in July, so not far away now. And the makeup of the Senate, just 24 people, is very important. You need a two-thirds majority, or at least 16 senators, to vote yes to the impeachment for it to work. And I think, you know, it's on a knife edge. And this election, Sarah Duterte seems to have got at least four, but maybe five of the 12 senators elected are going to support her, or are likely to. And Marcos got six. So there's only one sort of, you know, could go either way. And I think that turns out like she's got pretty well eight certain votes out of the 24. And she just needs one more to be able to block the impeachment. And that would then lead to a election in 2028 where she would be the candidate for the Dutertes. And it's hard to predict how this would all work out. And then the Marcoses would have to put up somebody else from the Marcos family. Yeah, that's how it is at the moment.
Well, you've got the House and you've got the Senate, but you've also got many other positions up for grabs at elections like this.
Yes, yes. Well, I haven't got a picture of the fallout across the country of like who's got the won the governorships. And then there's all the local mayors as well. I think from some of the media I've been reading, there's been quite a few changes happen at these levels as well. But they tend to still be, you know, one dynasty against another, fighting it out. And you can see that some of them would be aligned with Marcos and some would be aligned with the Dutertes. Some are just sort of more local, but they tend to have these alignments nationally just because the whole election stuff has become so sophisticated. You know, you've got to see that, you know, the sort of elections I'm describing in the Philippines, they take a lot of money. The people who put up the money see it as an investment and they want a return on their investment. So, you know, the corruption of government contracting and procurement, the use of slush funds, they call it pork barrel in the Philippines, is rampant. So getting your hands on pork barrel and also getting your potentially some sort of other kickbacks through contracting, these are the things that people are fighting for to get the return on their investment. So it can be deadly, you know, and quite ruthless.
Has Marcos made any comments since the election?
He's been pretty quiet, as far as I can tell. He's, I think, thanked everybody. But I think in behind the scenes, there's a lot of recalculation going on about what to do. You know, and it won't be good for the people. I mean, just like in Australia, that election last Monday was about the cost of living. And, you know, really, poverty is very grinding in the Philippines. And wages or incomes are just not moving, in fact, often going backwards with inflation in this last few years. So Marcos and Duterte together in 2022 promised to make life better. In fact, they said it would be like a golden era, this era. So, you know, people are a bit frustrated. And it's not surprising that, you know, the Marcos team didn't do so well, especially when they're being attacked by their former ally, Duterte. So, and the Dutertes are claiming that they're more with the grassroots. You know, they use that very ugly street language, that they're the ones to deliver. But of course, they haven't delivered either. It's a frustration for the people, I think. One other angle to this election has been that there was a massive military exercise conducted during the election campaign period. It only finished on the 9th of May, and the election was 3 days later, with about 9,000 or 10,000 US troops in the country, and altogether of 14,000 or so, including some Australians, some hundreds of Australian troops, practicing really for a war with China, fighting it from the Philippines. There was a lot of media coverage of that, you know, the very sophisticated missiles and other equipment deployed, and really sending the message to the Filipino people that they're under threat of invasion by China, which is really got no basis. But that was the sort of overall sort of geopolitical atmosphere of the elections, and therefore people were encouraged to support the government. You know, looking at the outcome, it wasn't so good. You could say Marcos's team more or less won, but by only a margin. And it was more like a stalemate between his forces and the Dutertes.
Have Trump's tariffs made any difference to the Philippines?
They would be hurt by them, but, you know, we're in this interregnum now where we're not sure. But even the imposition of 10% on Philippines is going to hurt that economy. It's very much fragile. There's a lot of low-cost assembly and garment making and so on going on in the Philippines, which then is exported out to the global markets. And of course, obviously the US market is one of the biggest ones. So if there's even a 5% impact, you know, like 5% less sales into the US, that will hurt. That would mean closure of some of these factories and more unemployment. It's not been helpful to the Filipinos that this has happened.
Well, your major concern for the people of the Philippines is the human rights or the lack of it. Does this election change anything for the better or the worse?
I think it's likely that the argument between the Dutertes and the Marcoses provides some more public space for a real assertion of the rights of the people, which are being threatened or abused, whereas before the messaging from a united Marcos Duterte administration and the Dutertes before was that human rights was only achieved by killing the rebels. It's sort of, you know, it was like a perverse way of talking about human rights. So when they mean killing the rebels, they mean killing a lot of civilians as well. And on top of that, there was the drug war, which was just killing poor people who, you know, somebody didn't like. It's not a great improvement from the election, I think. You know, we've got a stalemate between these two deadly groups at the top, and people, you know, obviously those people who want to improve the situation are going to use every opening to make their case better, and there are opportunities to do that. But, you know, there's no real change from the Marcoses in the way the police work, the way the military work, or the ombudsman works. So when a civilian person has their relative, their family member abducted or even killed, and they go to complain, that they just get rebuffed at the first point of contact. So, you know, there really is still a profound sense of there is no justice, especially in the Philippine judicial system. That's why you can imagine, you know, when the International Criminal Court finally got a hold of Duterte and put him in jail, you know, there was a euphoric sense of, at last, you know, some justice has come, at last.
Any news as to when this case might come to fruition?
No, we can't really predict it, but September 23 is the next hearing date for the Duterte case in The Hague. And that hearing is like a panel of judges making an assessment that the evidence provided by the prosecutor is of sufficient gravity to allow the case to go forward. So it is a little barrier, but it's highly unlikely that there will be any delay. Depending on those judges confirming, yes, this case has got solid grounds, then they would set a date for the trial. And that would be in 2026. So it's still super slow, but I think, you know, we can be confident that Rodrigo Duterte will go on trial sometime in 2026 in The Hague.
Is red tagging still happening, and in particular areas worse than others?
Yes, it's intense. It's intense. So I think whether you can say which areas, you know, it doesn't really matter. In this election, for instance, the terribly named National Task Force to End Local Communist Armed Conflict denounced the Commission on Elections because the Commission on Elections had instructed it to cease red tagging. There you go. Even the commissioners of the Commission on Election were accused of being communist supporters or terrorist supporters. There's no limit at the moment. There is no limit. It's only a matter of political judgment or calibration of the strategy that determines exactly how red tagging is used in the Philippines. It's really, really shocking.
And are the people of Mindanao suffering the most, or is this over the countries, in the countryside, in the cities?
I think you could say rural areas or countryside is suffering far more than people in the urban areas, where there's more eyeballs on the situation and, you know, more potential help, you know, from lawyers and organised groups. But in the countryside, yes, we definitely have the red tagging. But we also have artillery strikes and aerial bombardment. The military coming in and occupying the whole barangay, setting up their camp in the school, you know, or the clinic. and then, you know, going door to door and interrogating everybody. So it's you know, much more intense in the rural areas. And of course, it's in the rural areas that most of the people live. Something like 70% of the population outside of the main cities, you know, like they're outside of Manila, Cebu City, Davao City. What we've had to do is be very, very careful for the safety of our participants in this international observer mission. And this time it's been good. But what it means is they're not speaking up, they're not posting anything to social media while they're in the Philippines. And we're using spokespeople outside the Philippines to be their voice. One of them is Lee Rhiannon, who's a former Australian Greens senator, and similar church figures or other leaders in Europe and North America playing the same role. So, yeah, but we've managed to protect and keep safe our people. And on the other hand, you can see people are still willing to volunteer to go despite the obvious dangers in the situation.
Thanks once again, Peter.
Thank you very much. It's a really good story to tell, a very tough one, but it's very important. And we let the world know that this election was really not credible.
And I've been speaking with Peter Murphy, who's the chairperson of the ICHRP, the International Coalition for Human Rights in the Philippines.
What's taking place in Palestine is horrendous.
Here are some ways that you can keep yourself informed and involved.
Listen in to Palestine Remembered every Saturday morning at 9:30 a.m. or listen to the podcast. Join the APAN mailing list at apan.org.au for updates, news about actions you can get involved in, and where you can donate to provide humanitarian assistance.
Listen to other news and current affairs programs on 3CR that also cover Palestine.
The oppression of the Palestinian people has been going on for 75 years. It has to stop. You can be part of making that happen by staying informed and active.
APAN is a proud supporter of 3CR.
We know you love listening to 3CR, but we also know that many of you haven't downloaded the Community Radio Plus app yet.
The app lets you tune in anywhere and share the station with your friends.
So, show the love and share the love, and search Community Radio Plus wherever you get your apps.
On the program last week, we heard from a number of commentators looking back on the results of the recent federal elections. Today, just one more. I'm speaking with RMIT Senior Lecturer Binoy Campmark. And Binoy, it seems that everyone's got an opinion on why, who, about these last elections. What's your take on it all?
Well, I always think that when one examines elections, one has to do a nice comparison, sort of a cross comparison between the before and after, especially with commentators who have one view and then remarkably a view that is remarkably then revised after the fact. There's a lot of retrospective fitting with commentary on elections. And we should not forget that with this election, first of all, no one predicted the scale of Labour's victory, not a single, there wasn't a single prediction on that scale. Certainly, you know, I felt that Labour had a good chance of getting in, but with a minority or certainly a minority status. But what I found interesting was that it then got repackaged afterwards, you know, by individuals such as Phil Khoury at the Australian Financial Review, and a range of other commentators, even on the ABC, that this was due to Labour's extraordinary electoral campaign. It was due to Albanese's polished performance. This was certainly didn't quite look that remarkable in the course of the 5 weeks, to be honest. What tended to come together, I think, was that there were, of course, external shocks. I think one of the things that Albanese should have been saying, you know, in that conversation with Trump was, thank you, Mr. Trump, you helped me, a bit like the way you helped Mike Carney win the president, the prime ministerial elections there in Canada. The Trump factor, also the Pope factor, of course, you know, taking oxygen out of the election campaign of Dutton, having no coverage, because, of course, communication is the essence of election campaigning. If you can't communicate your messages across, that's always going to be a problem. And then ultimately, of course, you need a message to communicate, and Dutton's message was always flimsy, one-dimensional, incredibly tacked on, you know, defense policy announced in 10 days before in the election poll about a 3% increase to 3% GDP on military expenditure. Then on what, given the fact Australia's already knee-deep in AUKUS, revisions and confusions about would there be 41,000 civil servants sacked or not, confusions about tax policy, confusions about you know, little dithering things over excise and so on, fuel excise. So it, all in all, it was a poor campaign from the coalition, but it wasn't exactly spectacular from Labour either.
But they won very handsomely.
They did. And I suppose it's just an indication of how poorly the coalition did in convincing people that there might be, you know, even deserve an increased number of seats. They got an absolute, you know, walloping in some key areas. It was actually quite remarkable. And I suppose it's also fair to say that Albanese did certainly campaign far better this time than he did, you know, in 2022, where he was quite, you know, he looked very shonky. But the fact of the matter is, you know, his government, through its time in office, let's not forget, and this is again part of the retrospective narrative, at one point, Dutton's coalition looked rather pretty. It was sitting rather pretty before the election. And there were even conservative pundits, especially, of course, late at night pundits, usually Sky News. But nonetheless, there were those predicting a Dutton victory. You know, and of course, they have to now walk back on that. But still, you know, we can forget things in the moment and think that it was always deigned to be so. Whereas in actual fact, Albanese's government was not a spectacular one. It was incremental, unambitious. It walked back on its promises in many areas. Whistleblower reform, the environment, the appalling subservience to the United States regarding AUKUS, the continued funding of U.S. shipyards in the context of that agreement. All of these things are really dark spots. But the fact of the matter remains that it just wasn't evidently bad enough to convince voters not to vote for them.
Well, did his minders and his advisers let him down, or was this Dutton pure?
I think, well, it was clear from the Dutton's part that he was getting some very bad advice. I think there was this idea, and this is the problem with the Liberals. They're facing... it was clear that they decided, certainly, and the turning point seemed to be in 2022, rather than actually looking at their faults of that campaign, the Morrison campaign, and the result in their defeat. You know, reviews have been done by the party itself, and some of these have been just filed away to gather dust. And these reviews noted, for example, the need to address the Liberals' woman problem, the representation, where they're simply not representative of female voters. They don't even have a policy worth noting in any case, you know, regarding women in the electorate. So that was really stark, and this wasn't addressed at all. If anything, it went backwards under Dutton. And things like, for example, what do you do with millennials? What do you do with the housing market? What do you do with individuals like that? And it was very clear that the polling they were doing, and this came out in some discussions, I know Christopher Pyne made mention of this on the 7:30 report, that they were simply not... Whatever they were polling, whoever they were polling, they were simply not getting that kind of negativity that came out in the final result.
But what was not addressed at this election by the two main parties was Palestine.
Well, yes. A couple of things actually were not addressed, of course. Yes, the issue of certain foreign policy areas. So what happened was, it was very convenient in a sense to use Trump as a distraction on tariffs, on upending various global norms, and in the process, of course, not addressing either the complicity or the continued aiding and conniving with Israel, the relationship with Israel, the IDF, for example. Australia still has a defense relationship with the IDF. And even though there's this ongoing issue about to what extent Australian parts make up weaponry in the context of the campaign, say in Gaza, by the Israeli forces, there is still the reality that the Australian Defence Forces and the Israeli Defence Forces have a close relationship. And it is a very uncomfortable one in the context of what's happening in Gaza and even more broadly in the Middle East with Israeli policy.
It doesn't seem to be uncomfortable for the Labour Party.
No, it doesn't. And unfortunately, and I think what is interesting, again, and this is another thing that's come out certainly recently as well, in the factional disputes happening in the party, is that the Labour right, especially the New South Wales Labour right, is very influential, and that is quite pro-Israeli. So the Palestinian aspect, or any Palestinian pro-Palestinian voices in the party, would have suffered at the hands of the ignominious Labour right, unfortunately. So. Yes, unfortunately, what we're going to get is more of the same regarding that. We're going to get some very weak statements about civilian suffering, but we're also going to have very little done in the context of addressing Israeli brutality, which is only becoming more pronounced and more provocative as the weeks go on.
And Ed Cusick had to go?
Yes, exactly. This is the thing. You know, a well-performing, one of the better cabinet members, but albeit an individual with certain views, as we know, of course, having mentioned his own views about Palestine, about Palestinians and the Israeli campaign there. Yes, he was certainly earmarked as a troublemaker, and obviously the factional bosses felt that he should be moved on. So perversely, we have actually a very talented minister, certainly one of the most competent on the front bench of an otherwise, to a large extent, lackluster front bench, I would have to say. And he was moved on. So we'll see what his next step is on the back benches.
It seems to be tit for tat. We'll get rid of the Muslim and we'll get rid of the prominent Israelis, Australian supporter of Israel at the same time with Mark Dreyfus.
Yes. Yes. And that's why it's factional trade-off. And this is one of the reasons why, the Labour Party has great traditions. It is one of the remarkable parties of Australian politics, but it does have an awful tendency to tribalism, and its factional battles are ruthless and do involve exactly this trade-off of casualties and sacrificial lambs and so on. It's quite an ugly sight, actually, and it makes often little sense except to the cliques and the tribal factions.
Well, the other issue I'd like you to talk about is regarding Signal. Well, that to me was a new word until a couple of weeks ago. I'm sure other people knew about it. But what and who is Signal?
Well, Signal is an online end-to-end encryption application that was actually developed privately. It wasn't a government application. That's one of the first things to note. So it's very interesting to now see government officials across the world, politicians as well, using it, because it was maligned by U.S. law enforcement for many years as being responsible for dark transactions and unaccountable transactions on the web and also for communications. So the usual term bad actors is used in the context of Signal users. And what do we see happening? We see the U.S. government, especially officials in the Trump administration, making extensive use of Signal. And this came out in March when the former National Security Advisor, Mike Waltz, added the editor of The Atlantic, Jeffrey Goldberg, to a communications chain on Signal. And in the process, it surfaced that the very delicate details about attacking Yemeni installations and infrastructure by U.S. Using U.S. weapons and using U.S. forces were going to take place. Details of logistics were discussed, types of weaponry discussed, targets discussed, and a range of other things. But unbeknownst, seemingly, to the bumbling Waltz, Goldberg had been added. So Goldberg received this material as well when he shouldn't have. The White House then denied there was anything sensitive in the material, so Goldberg decided to publish parts of what was revealed. And I think that is as interesting a story as Signal. Signalgate's not merely the fact that there was this security lapse from a Trump administration official. It's also the fact that Signal is being used and Signal has a disappearing function. That's one of the things that's problematic. Officials can use it, communicate with each other, communicate with officials on any subject, however sensitive, and that material can disappear. And so there's no traceability about the messages. And that's very problematic if you're a government official, because these are government records. If you're communicating with other officials, these violate laws on in terms of archiving and so on. So that's very problematic. And in fact, there is a legal suit now being pursued in the United States against the Trump administration by a few NGOs, concerned attorneys, wanting, seeking declaratory relief and an injunction on the government from actually destroying any of the messages associated with SignalGate. But then I think the third part, which is, and this was omitted in the context of discussing Signal with the revelations here with Waltz, is that the attitude to it was, of course, one of horror, that there was a bumbling official prone to lapses of security. This would endanger U.S. lives. But I would also argue from another perspective that it was interesting how the media reacted to it, rather than saying, well, actually, it's also good to have leaks, good to be, as it were, privy to what is happening in the Trump administration, because a lot of the material discussed in the attacks on Yemen, on the proposed attacks of Yemen, were on infrastructure that wasn't military. There was certainly one instance where an individual was targeted because he was seen to be the chief, missileer was the expression used, Houthi missileer. And this individual's, the building whose girlfriend he lived in, he was going to go into, and the building was going to be destroyed in a proposed attack. Now, that, remember, is a civilian building. It's not a military installation. And the targeting in Yemen by U.S. forces has been almost as atrocious as Israeli targeting in Gaza in terms of killing civilians. So that's something that should have been discussed but wasn't discussed. So there are many aspects of SignalGate that are quite fascinating.
Well, look at it in context with Australia. And I'll just read this paragraph from Independent Senator David Pocock. Sensibly observes that using such platforms in the absence of coherent, thorough policy can be done to encourage opacity in policy and making final decisions. The use of messaging apps to deliberately avoid scrutiny through freedom of information is deeply concerning and will have long-term negative impacts on the health of our democracy, good governance, and the accountability of our decision makers.
Yes, and David Pocock is absolutely right, because one thing that SignalGate did also reveal was naturally it brought in concerns about what Australian officials might be doing. And as it turns out, Australian officials, also prime ministers, cabinet officials, members of the Australian civil service, or public service rather, have been making extensive use of online platforms. So not just the use of Signal, but for example WhatsApp and so forth. So an example, is that Malcolm Turnbull, for example, was in communications when he was Prime Minister with then former Prime Minister Kevin Rudd on the issue of his potential running for UN Secretary, for the post of UN Secretary General. That's an example. They used WhatsApp in that particular instance. There have been instances where security officials in ASIO, for example, have been using Signal to communicate as well. And it has been revealed from ASIO Chief Mike Burgess that they have no policy on the disappearing messages issue. So because they're using Signal, and because Signal's specialty is that it makes messages disappear, this is a highly problematic thing. Burgess said in estimates, he said that, well, we don't make decisions via Signal, I think was what his statement was, but he claimed to have a notebook that documented things. So that notebook itself is part, will be archived or part of the records. But I just don't think that's good enough. And you need to have a situation where if you are communicating through this channel, that channel must preserve the messages somehow. And so that's why Pocock's point is a very salient one, because Australia does not have a coherent policy when it comes to this matter. And in fact, this was revealed very much in a recent report, I think it was released last month, that discussed this very thing. The report from the Office of the Australian Information Commissioner and the National Archives. It was released in March. And what is troubling about this is that it surveyed 22 government agencies and found that 16 of them use these online end-to-end encrypted message apps. And what is fascinating is that only 3 prohibited their use and 3 have no stated policy on the matter. So it's very clear in Australia that not having a coherent policy risks undermining the Freedom of Information Act, it risks undermining the Privacy Act, and it risks undermining the Archives Act. 3 very important pieces of legislation in the Australian canon when it comes to dealing with information. And this is something that's incredibly troubling, and I don't see it being addressed. This is the thing. There've been certain promises from the Attorney General's Department to do something about it, but as we know, the Dreyfus Attorney General Department, now we'll see what happens with the new iteration, but the previous one was rather slow in getting things done in certain reforms.
Well, how else could they do it?
Well, I mean, I think the policy of not using it would be a start, or rather using a function, making it mandatory that when they communicate on these channels, that it is subject to some preservation and some scrutiny, because not doing so will undermine, or does undermine, the very transparency agenda, if you like, that's indicative in the legislation. So they will have to have reforms made. I mean, the recommendations of the Information Commissioner are precisely this, that they have to bring in a program or some kind of protocol across all government agencies as to what to do when you use Signal or when you use WhatsApp or when you use any of these other systems. Because if you don't do that, then we're actually imperiling the whole record-keeping system.
Don't hold your breath.
No, I won't. I don't think I will. I think it's one of those things where the great irony of ironies is that a particular system like Signal, a particular app like Signal that was demonized and seen as rotten because it was evading government control, has become a subject of government use precisely for doing the very same thing that government said were awful when it was in private hands. And now that they're making use of these private applications, they suddenly think it's a wonderful thing to do precisely because it keeps them beyond our scrutiny, and that is very problematic.
Thank you once again, Binoy.
Always a pleasure, Jan. Anytime.
And Dr. Binoy Kantmark is Senior Lecturer at RMIT University.
Kafirs are Palestinian scarves, and they're a symbol of support for justice for the Palestinian people. From the traditional black and white kafir to an array of modern designs, explore the range and order online or drop by 3CR during business hours. Wear your support for the rights of Palestinians. Go to kafirs.org.au. That's kufiyas.org.au. A 3CR supporter.
Make your donation during our annual Radiothon. It's your station, your voice.
Donate to the 3CR Radiothon fundraiser this June.
To donate, call 0394198377 or go online at 3cr.org.au.
3CR Radiothon 2025. Your station, your voice.
And now we hear part two of the history of Guyana in South America with Sasha Gellis-Lakakis.
But something else they did, which ultimately sank this sort of initial dream for a unified, non-racial vision for the country, was CIA and British involvement in essentially funding a splinter faction of the PPP. And the way they did that was they used Forbes Burnham, this Afro-Guyanese lawyer, who was the reason, of course, that the PPP had attracted the Afro-Guyanese population. They essentially began to use him as a means of creating a faction within this PPP that would go against Chetty Jagan. This did happen in the 1953 election. They were still the same party at this point, but he essentially operated a separate faction within the party. Now, this faction only won 3 seats, and Jagan's faction, which was the majority of the party, won 9. So goes to show that it wasn't as popular as Chetty Jagan, and that this sort of divisiveness wasn't yet taking full root. But it did show that there were long-running disputes between the Indo-Guyanese and the Afro-Guyanese. And of course, this had been fermented by the British for many, many decades prior to the 1950s. You know, this preceded the PPP and the labor movement, because, of course, a lot of the Indo-Guyanese began to occupy more financially stable posts. They moved up the hierarchy of the public service, and the British did deliberately create a division between disenfranchised Afro-Guyanese and a small section of the Indo-Guyanese, a visible section of the Indo-Guyanese, who were essentially, you know, a part of the British colonial machinery. Did lead to resentment between the two sides, and Forbes Burnham did quite skillfully use that simmering tension, and he ultimately split. Forbes Burnham left the party. He left the PPP, and he announced the creation of his own party, which was the People's National Congress, the PNC. Now, to this day, the PPP and the PNC are the leading parties in Guyana's politics. Sadly, now, they are divided. Pretty much, you know, the only thing that distinguishes them is the ethnic loyalties of their voting base. Of course, the PPP now are the party of the Indo-Guyanese. PNC is the party of the Afro-Guyanese, by and large. Both of these parties claimed socialist roots. Even though Forbes Burnham moved away from the PPP, split off from them, his policies in terms of economics and, you know, political organization were virtually the same. The only difference was he was going to commit to promoting Afro-Guyanese into the top echelons of politics, and he stated he would exclude the Indo-Guyanese. So quite divisive sort of racial politics coming into play. First, the PPP continued to insist that it was a multiracial party and that, you know, the Afro-Guyanese people should basically resist this sort of attempt to create racial tension, because it was well known at this time that the CIA was funding Forbes Burnham and that they were behind a lot of these policies, these racial policies that he was promoting. And, you know, it is interesting to note that even though Burnham was a socialist and that the PNC was espousing socialist principles, that the CIA and the British would have preferred him over Chetty Jagan. Of course, because Chetty Jagan still had this idea of a united socialist Guyana. And I think calculations of the Americans and the British was that being able to use the PNC and its sort of racial overtones would make it easier to control, and that it would be easier to foment tensions. This is actually, sadly, what eventuated when we saw the lead up to the next series of elections after the British had sent soldiers and repressed the 1953 elections, elections organized for 1964. And these were going to be the final elections to take place under the British mandate, because the British had agreed that Guyana would be independent in 1966. So this was the election to decide the first government of post-independence Guyana. Kennedy administration and the British Crown were intensely involved in rigging these elections. In spite of all of these efforts, in spite of, you know, the inflaming of ethnic tensions, the gerrymandering of the diaspora vote, the gerrymandering of the borders for electoral districts in Guyana itself, the PPP still won the election, increased their vote of 43% to 46%. The PNC, Forbes Burnham's party, maintained its electoral result, 41% in the 1964 election. With the new gerrymandered electoral boundaries, the PPP won less seats. So even though they had won the popular vote, it was the PNC who had won, you know, the required number of seats to form government, in alliance with another minor party called the Justice Party, which the CIA had actually just created. It was a completely artificial party that the Americans had backed. Now, the procedure in a situation like this, where neither of the two parties has a majority, that the procedure in Guyana is to allow the incumbent government or the incumbent party, which at this time was the PPP, according to the elections of 1953, to basically have a chance to try and work out some sort of coalition. What the Governor General did was completely freeze out Chetty Jagan from these negotiations and automatically give the PNC a chance to negotiate a coalition government, which of course the British and the Americans knew would happen because they were going to align with the CIA-created Justice Party. Total flagrant violation of the political norms, the legal norms in Guyana. Then this was a sort of lawfare coup against Chetty Jagan, and he was removed from power by the Governor General, arrested again for a few years, but then released. And we saw Forbes Burnham become the first president of post-independence Guyana. This is where things get quite interesting. Forbes Burnham was the favourite candidate of the CIA and of the British. However, he did state prior to the election that he was still running his party, the PNC, along socialist principles. But what ended up happening was, at least in the latter half of the 1960s, Forbes Burnham led a pretty moderate course. Politically, economically, he maintained close relations with the British, with the Americans, no major radical economic reforms. But in 1970, he flipped almost overnight and veered in the extreme to the left-wing side of politics. He announced unilaterally the creation of the Cooperative Republic of Guyana, which is, you know, the inclusion of the word cooperative is an explicit reference to socialism. And he announced in the Declaration of Sofia, which is a town in Guyana, that he was now orienting Guyana along explicitly socialist principles, economically and politically. Even though the PPP wasn't outlawed, it did essentially become a one-party state in Guyana with the PNC dominating elections because of the electoral gerrymandering that, ironically, the British and the Americans had helped engineer. So this essentially ensured continuous PNC rule from 1964 up until 1985. He established relations with Cuba in 1972, with the Soviet Union in 1970, and then later with North Korea in 1974. He actually did implement a socialist economic program. He nationalized all major industries in Guyana, so the sugar industry, the bauxite industry, essentially reduced the private sector's share of the economy to about 10%. And of course, the British and the Americans became very hostile to the Burnham administration and to Guyana. So they withdrew their funding from Guyana. They withdrew their aid that they were giving Guyana. They stopped short of sanctions because at the end of the day, they still had financed his rise to power. And there were a number of organizations in Guyana that the British and the Americans used to continue influencing politics. One of them was the House of Israel, which was an American-based organization that became very influential in Guyana. It's essentially an extremist Christian cult that Burnham was quite close with. You know, and this is one of the paradoxes of this leader. He was very, very religious himself. He was a Christian, gave a lot of money to the House of Israel, and they ended up undertaking a lot of terrorist attacks against the opponents of the PNC regime. So they would attack PPP political organizers, former allies of Chetty Jagan, who were now not involved in politics. Another very, very well-known friend of Forbes Burnham was, of course, the cult that ultimately culminated in the Jonestown massacre. It reached international headlines. Again, this was a cult that began in the United States. Of course, what happened was that in 1978, about 900 members of this cult went over to Guyana, and they all committed mass suicide on the orders of their cult leader, Jim Jones. It was well known again that Jim Jones was a very close friend of Forbes Burnham. Now, we're not quite sure why Burnham fraternized with these weird extremist cults, but he did. And, you know, this put Guyana in the international spotlight in the late 70s. And there were calls by the opposition, by the PPP, to investigate Burnham's role in the Jonestown massacre. They accused him of being somehow involved in the mass suicide. There was no evidence really to suggest that that was the case, but certainly Burnham had given the cult a lot of money in the years leading up to the massacre in 1978. We saw this sort of indiscriminate violence really take root in some parts of Guyana. Of course, Walter Rodney, who I've spoken about in previous interviews, for example, in the Jamaica interview, he was Guyanese. Now, he was a very, very important political scholar and political theorist. He wrote the very well-known book, How Europe Underdeveloped Africa, which basically very clearly and incisively described and analyzed the mechanisms of colonial rule and then post-colonial exploitation across the African continent. He actually created the Workers' Party within Guyana as a sort of third way between the PPP and the PNC, but this party has never really won any sort of substantial share of the vote. Ultimately, Walter Rodney was killed by extremists of the House of Israel in 1980. It's largely recognised that Burnham ordered this assassination, even though the government rejected it at the time. By the 80s, we do see this sort of very unstable regime beginning to sort of slide into stagnation. I do want to emphasise that the socialist economic policies that Burnham implemented did benefit the Afro-Guyanese quite substantially. It was Afro-Guyanese who occupied all the important posts in government. They occupied all the important military posts in government. There were very substantial cash handouts to poor Afro-Guyanese. This is a reason behind the enduring popularity of the PNC among the Afro-Guyanese. It is almost 100% support for this party amongst the Afro-Guyanese to this day because of that legacy. In spite of the general deterioration in public security, the general sort of economic stagnation that began to happen in the 1980s, the Afro-Guyanese, which have traditionally been marginalised, were well looked after under the PNC across those 20 years. Now, of course, you know, the Indo-Guyanese were targeted by the armed forces, by the police. Oftentimes, a lot of innocent people were targeted. In some cases, you know, there were legitimate claims of a commercial abuse or debt abuse of Indo-Guyanese businesses against the Afro-Guyanese. This was a practice that was widespread in some parts of Guyana, and Burnham, if only for political clout, took action against it. But there were a lot of innocent Indo-Guyanese that were also, you know, swept up in this very racialized government, you know, that made explicit delineations between the Indo-Guyanese and the Afro-Guyanese. His regime didn't actually collapse. He died in 1985, still in power, and still in undisputed power, I might add. Essentially, he's the person who would succeed him, whose name was Desmond Hoyt. He initiated an opening up. He had entered into negotiations with the PPP as a means of sort of trying to stop the spiraling violence that was taking place in parts of Guyana with these cults that Burnham had financed and these sort of racial tensions. Desmond Hoyt in the late 80s initiated an opening up of Guyana's political scene. There were the first essentially competitive elections in Guyana in 1992, and this was again between the PNC and the PPP. The PPP by this point had undertaken a very, very significant transformation because the PNC had essentially co-opted the socialist policies of the PPP. They had essentially taken a lot of steam out of the PPP's original agenda. And so they essentially veered to the right as a means of differentiating themselves from the Afro-Guyanese party. They said, we are now advocates of neoliberalism. You know, this is the 90s, the socialist bloc has collapsed, and the PPP will now be the custodians of a new neoliberal program in Guyana. We're going to move away from the quote-unquote the failed socialist experiment of the Burnham decades, and we're going to move towards the free market economy. Of course, at this time, you know, we see the opening up, and the Indo-Guyanese are the majority of the population, and so unsurprisingly, the PPP has swept to power. In fact, since 1992, because of the ethnic imbalance, and because, again, in 1992, the PPP had constitutional amendments passed that reformed the boundaries, this time in favour of the Indo-Guyanese, we have only seen one PNC government since 1992 in Guyana, with one exception, which was in 2015 when the PNC returned to power. But since that time, the PPP has consistently implemented a neoliberal trajectory. It has been one of the most forceful proponents of neoliberalism in Latin America. It completely dismantled the state bauxite and state sugar companies that had dominated during the PNC years in the 20th century, and it has sold these off to private interests, to British interests, American interests, and to a growing clique of very wealthy Guyanese politicians and speculators, most of whom are Indo-Guyanese. Because, of course, it is now a country that is ruled by Indo-Guyanese interests, much like it was ruled by Afro-Guyanese interests in the late 20th century. Now all of the political posts are Indo-Guyanese. You know, there have been long-standing grudges, again, you know, these simmering tensions between the Afro-Guyanese and the Indo-Guyanese. They've never exploded into outright ethnic conflict like they did in the 20th century. But certainly there have been isolated cases of killings in certain parts of Guyana across the 21st century. And there were accusations in the 90s that the PPP had organized death squads to go around and kill Afro-Guyanese squatters who were essentially trying to go onto empty land in the interior that was owned by PPP politicians and businessmen. This is still a recurring issue, but consequences of neoliberalism have been debilitating for everyone in the country. Guyana currently has the highest poverty rate in Latin America, South America, not in the entirety of Latin America. 48% of the country lives in poverty or extreme poverty. And this is in spite of Guyana's discovery in 2020 of the largest per capita oil reserves on Earth. They aren't the largest reserves of any country on Earth, but per capita, per person in Guyana, these are the largest oil reserves, 11 billion barrels of oil reserves. But where are they? In the Essequibo region. This has been the flashpoint of Guyana's modern polity, been in the news very recently, in fact, in the past 3 or 4 months. And there's been some more recent news from the Essequibo region in the past few days, actually. This Essequibo controversy was raised again in 1966. Venezuela and Guyana brought the Essequibo dispute to Geneva. And I consider this to be the only legitimate negotiations that have taken place because it was the only negotiations that have actually involved Guyana and Venezuela and no one else. And what was agreed, there was, an inconclusive result on the dispute, but what was agreed was that neither country would take unilateral action over the resources or the territory of Essequibo until there were further negotiations. Now, there weren't further negotiations up until last year. The reason behind this was, again, there was recalcitrance between the two sides. There were some skirmishes throughout the 20th century. The Venezuelans in the 1970s seized Ancuco Island, which is an island at the mouth of the Cuyuni River in the Essequibo, and they've maintained control of that to this day. Guyanese have launched skirmishes and attacks against Venezuelan civilians. Then, in violation of the Geneva Agreement, this was throughout the 20th century. But what has happened now that they've discovered these massive oil reserves offshore in the Essequibo waters is that the PPC regime in Guyana, and this is led by Irfan Ali, who is a banker, a business speculator, very, very neoliberal right-wing, very close with the British and the Americans. He has given ExxonMobil license rights over the Essequibo region's oil reserves and has allowed them to begin exploring the oil reserves in these waters with Guyanese Defence Force protection. So they have violated the 1966 Guyana Agreement, and consistently since 2020, they have sent their soldiers and their patrol boats into Guyana with ExxonMobil exploration vessels, and they have begun exploring for oil prospecting in the future once those oil reserves are fully developed. In a situation like this, Venezuela is not going to sit by and let this happen. And of course, Venezuela is a very assertive country now. It's led by the Socialist Party, the PSUV, by Nicolas Maduro. And they made very clear that if the Guyanese continued to infringe on the Essequibo region and continued to violate the 1966 Geneva Agreement, that Venezuela would take reciprocal action. Guyana ignored them, maybe thinking that because they had supposed British and American backing that the Venezuelans wouldn't do anything. Now, of course, the Venezuelans did do something. They sent their own patrol boats and they actually harassed an ExxonMobil exploration vessel. That was in 2023. And they essentially forced that vessel and the Guyanese Defence Force to turn away and go back. There was no casualties, no deaths or anything, but this was quite a tense standoff. Venezuela took further action because Guyana continued to insist on essentially violating the 1966 agreements, sending these ExxonMobil ships in, and even attempting to set up an oil rig at the mouth of the Cuyuni River. So Venezuela has held a referendum, this was in 2023, over the recognition of the Essequibo region as Venezuelan territory. 51% of the country turned out. This is higher than most US elections. This is higher than most Guyanese elections. And a resounding 95% of Venezuelans who voted to recognize the Essequibo as Venezuelan territory. And Maduro has announced that this year, in the regional elections and the governor elections in May, so it's going to be this month, next week, I believe, on the 25th, they are going to hold a vote in the Essequibo region. So for the first time, they are going to vote for a governor in the Essequibo region, and they are going to vote for local councillors, recognising it as part of Venezuela. Guyana has signed a military pact with the United Kingdom. Maduro has actually indicated that the Americans have set up a military base in the Guyanese jungle near the border. This hasn't been confirmed. The Americans, of course, deny it. I am inclined to believe the Venezuelan side that, you know, the British and the Americans really are mobilizing Guyana to be this sort of militaristic sort of spear against Venezuela, because it's not just ExxonMobil that we're concerned about, you know, which is going to loot what are Venezuelan resources, or at the very least what are resources that could benefit the people of the Essequibo. Guyana at this point is just selling off these resources. They are giving it away to ExxonMobil. But more than that, Guyana is being armed. This British military pact involves the British giving weapons and military training to Guyana, and the Americans as well. At the very least, they are using Guyana as a base to surveil, even without a base. But, you know, if this military base is in fact real, clearly they are mobilizing Guyana as this sort of Trojan horse against Venezuela. These elections will be significant. Now, I'm actually not sure how Venezuela is going to go about this. Venezuela now does have the military and the political authority to conduct these elections in the Essequibo. Guyana has abandoned this region for many decades. You know, as I mentioned, it's very sparsely populated. There's been no development. And it is very telling that once Venezuela announced that they would be holding elections in the Essequibo region, there were no major pro-Guyana protests in Guyana. There were no major demonstrations in Guyana against the Venezuelan declaration. And the Guyanese authorities had to announce that anyone in the Essequibo who voted in those Venezuelan elections will be charged with treason. Now, that is not the policy of a confident government or a government that believes it has will of the people behind it or the authority of the people behind it in the Essequibo. So I think the Guyanese government is aware, or at least is concerned, that a number of people in the Essequibo, nominally under Guyanese control still, will vote in these Venezuelan elections. Now, you know, that remains to be seen. We'll find out next week. This is really telling that the Guyanese regime is, you know, quite concerned, you know, that it has left this region abandoned. It is threatening to sell off everything to ExxonMobil so that a small clique in Georgetown can make money off it, essentially, and that they are militarizing this region. You know, the fact that the British and the Americans are getting involved in the Essequibo is very, very dangerous for the everyday people living there. And, you know, we've seen skirmishes, again, between the Venezuelan armed forces, the Bolivarian armed forces, and the Guyanese Defense Force. And in fact, in March this year, we saw some disputes, actual live ammunition was fired across the Cuyuni River. And last week, the Guyanese falsely accused Venezuelan soldiers of attacking Guyanese soldiers when, in fact, and this was later admitted by the Guyanese authorities because Venezuela called it out and had actual, you know, video footage from the soldiers there, that these were armed gangs which operate on both sides of the border in Venezuela and in Guyana. And this was armed gangs that attacked the Guyanese Defense Force, and they attacked the Bolivarian armed forces. So the fact that the Guyanese authorities are trying to lie to create some sort of false flag incident clearly demonstrates that they are working on behalf of the Americans and the British in this case. When Marco Rubio went on his Latin American tour a few months ago, one of the first countries he visited, one of the few as well, was Guyana. He went to a few countries in the Caribbean and he went to Guyana, which is telling. The United States is so involved now in the political dealings in that country. In summary, very sadly, Guyana is being grinded into deeper poverty by its own elite, by the PPP in particular, since the return to competitive elections. And I call them competitive because to say that these elections have, you know, since 1992 have been legitimate, as opposed to the pre-1992 elections, is a bit of a misnomer, because the PPP has rigged electoral boundaries just as the PNC did. But, you know, this PPP regime, which is led by Irfan Ali, this banker, is dragging Guyana to the precipice. They really are dragging Guyana to the precipice of a conflict with Venezuela. They are the ones who violated the 1966 agreement in the first place. They also held talks late last year and early this year. I believe it was in Barbados. Venezuela's president, Nicolas Maduro, and the prime minister, Irfan Ali of Guyana. And they, again, they signed an agreement saying that they would not take unilateral action without consulting the other leader. What did Guyana do just a few weeks after that? They sent in another ExxonMobil exploration vessel without consulting the Venezuelan government. So, you know, I do urge people who hear about, you know, this Venezuelan referendum that took place a few years ago, that Venezuela is building up its military on the border with the Essequibo region, to understand this history and to look at this history, because Guyana is not a victim. Guyana is being made out to be a victim in the international media, but at every turn, it has been Guyana who has violated international agreements, who has violated the in-principle agreements and the signed agreements between Venezuela and Guyana, and it is they who are mobilizing and militarizing the region, the Essequibo, and deliberately provoking a Venezuelan armed response. And it is a miracle that there hasn't been some sort of actual confrontation yet.
And many thanks to Sasha Gillies-Lekakis.
3CR, your station, your voice.
You've been listening to a podcast produced at 3CR Community Radio. It's Radiothon time. This year, we need to raise $275,000 to keep the station going. Any amount you can afford makes a big difference. It's so easy to donate. Head to 3cr.org.au/donate. We rely on the community's support. Thanks for listening.